those people want to, please, don't let somebody conquer us. Please don't let the Tigris and Euphrates flood so violently again this year. The propitiatory religion of Mesopotamia is utterly unlike what we find among the Hebrews. The idea of a pact, of a covenant, of a contract, of a mutual, a reciprocal deal. And it's not to trivialize to call it a deal. It was really understood that way. Each party had rights and obligations. Next, the idea of a uniquely chosen people. One God for one people. Now, you'll perhaps recall, again, that in an earlier lecture we said that there was very much a tendency in Mesopotamia, and we saw this in Egypt as well, though it worked a little differently in Egypt, a tendency towards syncretism. In other words, you add deities all the time. Physicists speak of the law of the conservation of energy or the law of the conservation of matter. We might say that in antiquity there was a law of the conservation of divinity. You didn't ever want to lose any. You just added. You see? Not so for the Hebrews. One God for one people. One God for one people. A remarkable notion. Really a quite remarkable notion. Now, over time, and this leads me to my next point, this notion of a covenant and this notion of a chosen people led to a series, we might say, of more mature reflections on the very nature of that deity. And there emerged the idea of exclusive monotheism. We have some hints of this in the various earliest sections of Genesis, the first book of the Hebrew Scriptures. There we find plural words used for God. Now, this could be polite. It could be a royal we. One has to acknowledge that possibility. But when, for example, Moses goes upon Sinai and is there given the law, the covenant is renewed. He is given what we think of as the Ten Commandments. We can all see the movie. We can see Charlton Heston standing on the mountain. The first of those commandments, I am the Lord your God. You shall not have false gods before you. Now, translated more strictly, the gods of strangers, the gods of other people. In other words, it doesn't say they're not out there. It says don't mess with them. What we seem to see at that point is what we learned to call, in connection with the Egyptians, henotheism or monolatry. You worship one God, but you don't deny that there's other ones out there. By the time we come to the prophet Isaiah, this sense of monotheism has evolved in an interesting kind of way. Now we meet the notion that there is one God, period. There are no others. That generated a very interesting tension. The covenant had been in the first place between God and Abraham. It had been in the second place between God and the people whom Moses had forged into one. And it meant in the third place between those people and the Torah. What now? If there is one God only, are all other people consigned to godlessness? Or is this God eventually to be for all of them as well? This was a question to which Jewish thinkers in antiquity gave many answers, as indeed they have given many answers in modern time. It remains a very controversial subject. But we can feel this tension most vividly, I think, most vividly in the book of Jonah. Now, the book of Jonah has often attracted attention for all the wrong reasons. Jonah, you may recall, had been told to go and preach in Nineveh, had been told to go and preach to the Assyrians. Now, as we'll see in more detail in the next lecture, these were really bad guys. These were awful people, and they were Gentiles to boot. They were not Hebrews. Jonah tries to flee. He doesn't want to accept this responsibility. He tries to flee. He takes ship, probably in one of the Phoenician ports, and sails out into the Mediterranean. So a great storm comes up. Jonah's pitched into the ocean. A whale or a big fish or something swallows him up and spits him out on the coast. And God says, listen, I told you you're going to Nineveh. Now get on about it. Well, the point is that in the way the story is told in the Hebrew Bible, and the way that Hebrews would have understood that story, it had nothing to do with whether Jonah was really in the belly of a fish or not, and why didn't he get digested and so on. The story was told in this wonderful and richly exaggerated way to say, if God tells you to do something, you're going to do it. You can't escape it. That moral is pretty clear. But what is fascinating is that God had told Jonah to go to Nineveh. Does this suggest universalism? Does this suggest now, you see, that this faith is for all people and not merely for the Hebrews? Well, as I said, that was a controversial point in antiquity. It has been controversial since. But we can feel the